President McDonald, members of the Board of Trustees, faculty, friends of the graduates, and the graduates, the greatest group of people on earth today. My name is next on the program. I may remind you of a celebrated character in one of Shakespeare's plays, Midsummer Night's Dream. Bottom, I believe it was, who wanted to play all the parts there were. In the orbit of church activities in which the general authorities all revolve, I have, since last with you in a like capacity, moved forward year by year around the orbit until I am now at that point where it is my turn again to be honored by the invitation to speak to you at your day of valedictory. Obedient to my duty and sensible to the honor, I am here. I wish first to express to you, graduates, the fullest measure of earned praise that you have finished with honor and reward the courses of study you began many months ago. To speak in old familiar and shopward figures, the way of your journey has not always been easy. There have been ruts in the road, even when it looked smoothest. I trust you've edged out of all of them. You must get out of them sometime. There have been long hills to climb, filled with boulders you had to clamber over or go around. You could not move them. Sometimes you wandered into long downgrade stretches, easy going, nothing in the way, lots of fun. The farther you went, the faster you ran. But you who looked carefully far ahead saw wrecks at the bottom. So you slowed up, turned about, and painfully, toilsomely, worked back to the main road. If any of your companions did not, among the wrecks at the bottom. Continuing our shopworn figure, you have been blessed in your travels by having at every crossroad someone placed to guide you, to tell you which road to take. You have been warned away from pitfalls. You have been encouraged when the going was hard. Kindness and well-wishing have been your ever-present companions. No one has sought to hinder, all have aimed to help. All were working in a common cause. You marched shoulder to shoulder along the way. It has been one for all and all for one. A great brotherhood and sisterhood, with some anxieties, troubles, sorrows, disappointments, all sweetened with a rich sprinkling of joy, and happiness came to all. Yet, fortunately or unfortunately, with enough of school day tragedy to make the sweet sweeter. Nor have your blessings ended with these, for some of you have paid your own way here at school. A great blessing. These know much that the rest of you will still have to learn. Of the rest, parents have kept most of you. Uncle Sam has kept a generous portion. Food, clothing, shelter have come in reasonable measure without much effort on your part. These have been glorious days, lived gloriously. You will go out with 1,000 memories that will hide away in the crannies of your minds against the day when, called forth by some trivial or tragic happening, they will clamber out of their hiding places to bring solace in the hour of grief and added joy to the moments of happiness. Perhaps for some, there will be in the secret chambers of the heart an unrequited love that, nurtured there over the years to come, will hallow a life of sacrifice. So it always has been. And ever will be in mortality. As you leave these portals today, thank God reverently for what he has done for you, for the blessings that have been yours, for the work he has given you to do, for the strength he has bestowed upon you to do it, for the truth he has let you garner. So much for this day. Perhaps it would be well if I ended here, and yet I feel that out of the almost 80 years I have lived, I might possibly add a few words of useful counsel about the old homely virtues out of which have grown every material blessing in arts, in pure and applied sciences, in music, in literature, with which you are now blessed. There are three impudent, brutal, conspiring inquisitors waiting to meet and question you as you go out of these doors today, to the north and to the south. They rarely separate or go about singly. You will not see them, but they are there, waiting. They will propound three questions. You may not hear them as you pass out with light laughter and gay carefreeness, but their questions will be recorded in your minds, and sooner or later your brain cells will play back the record to your ears. The first inquisitor, tall and gaunt, will ask, "What will you eat?" The second, dressed in tatters, will say, "What will you wear?" The third, wan, pale, nervous to the breaking point, will inquire, "Where will you sleep?" Food, clothing, shelter. These are the basic problems of mortal existence. Driven into the last corner, biological man does whatever it is necessary to do in order to live. In that corner, he will lie, steal, murder. But man is infinitely more than a biological unit. He is also a unit of intelligence and spirit, and these mitigate his ferocity when he is in extremis, even as the Lord has taught. Speaking to his disciples on the Mount of Olives, on the night before the crucifixion, he said, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." In the Passover chamber, before they went out to the Mount of Olives, Jesus repeated to his disciples, disputing among themselves who should be greatest, the thought he had before expressed, that he who would be greatest among his fellows must be the servant of all. Service to men, not enslaving them, is the high Christian virtue. Restraint, not indulgence, builds great character. I'm not unaware that some modern gamblers, dead to spiritual truth and alive only to the things of the flesh, deride or deny these and other great spiritual truths of the Master. But these scoffers know only this life. They know nothing of the eternities to come, either in faith or in fructifying hope. Do not listen to them. When the want for food, clothing, shelter begins to press hard upon you, then the flesh will almost smother the spirit. In the beginning, God gave to Adam and Eve three great commandments. The first was, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it." The second was, as to the relationship of husband and wife, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." The third came as God drove them from the garden, declaring to them, "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground." These are basic commandments to men. Cherish all of them in your hearts. We'll say a few words about the last of them. Most of us are physically and mentally indolent. Some of us are just plain lazy. Recently, this biological trait has been put into a great government culture vat and has developed a malignant virus, the Homo Dementicus. For the information of Dr. Sperry and Nibley and the other linguists, I will say that Homo is the Latin word for man. That is the genus name of this virus and of the bacteriophages I shall mention later. Moreover, I am not responsible for the Latin termination C-U-S. That designates the various species of this genus Homo. The U.S. is the regular Latin ending of the nominative case, singular, number, masculine, gender, second declension. I think that's right. Caesar and Cicero and other Romans before them, responsible for many of your midnight headaches, gave you this U.S. suffix. To this suffix, the prefix C has been added for the sake of euphony, making the full termination C-U-S, pronounced with a hard C. Cus, as a micus, Americanized, it's cuss. But to return to our medical discussions of bugs, I'll ask Dr. Martin to explain all this to Dr. Sperry and Nibley. This virus, Homo Dementicus, completely destroys all the sweat of thy face cells, both in the body and in the mind. It is most virulent and spreads with atomic speed and energy. In place of the sweat of thy face cells, Homo Dementicus leaves a growth of cancerous cells, alike virulent and deadly, which experts have named Homo Do-Nothing-Cus. The name comes from a Russian root, meaning the world or somebody owes each of us a living without work. The disease brings a luxurious drowsiness almost impossible to shake off. The victim dreams big. His imagination runs riot. He makes real the couplet of the grand bard, chapels become churches and poor men's cottages, princes' palaces. He moves mountains by the wave of his hand. He dries up oceans with a mere breath. Life has all the voluptuous experiences dreamed of by the opium slave. But this cancerous growth, Homo do nothing cus, is highly infectious and contagious, too. All ages, from youths up, of both sexes, are attacked indiscriminately. Like death, it has all seasons for its own. Non-filterable, non-isolated, most widely diffused, it is completely osmotic, mentally and physically, over the greatest distances. Dr. Eyring will explain osmotic to Dr. Sperry and Nibley. So far, only three bacteriophage specifics have been found against the cancer Homo Do-Nothing-Cus. The first, which has been known completely to destroy the cancer almost overnight, is named Homo Hungricus. When this bug really strikes, the dreamer moves. The second, not quite so efficient as the first, is called Homo Nothing to Ericus. The third is like the second for effectiveness, but it has a benumbing effect to the body. It is called Homo Freezumcus. These three are neither infectious nor contagious. They are the result of a sort of spontaneous generation, or maybe combustion, in the individual. These bring the Homo back to his senses. But the infected groups, these bug-drugged dreamers, luxuriating in the odoriferous ease of a stale but glamorous idleness, are now studying to develop a new specific that will destroy these three sense-restoring phagocytes, I guess it is. So far, they are experimenting with an early caveman bacteriophage. Homo, take what you want where you find it, cuss. Also known as Homo stilumcus. But to make this last bug really effective, they must provide another protective against the natural law of retribution and retaliation visited upon the Homo stilumcuses by their robbed victims. So the dreamers have developed a test tube culture of the bug Homo no jalumcus. This lets the robber go scot-free. However, up to now, they have not been able to produce this latter bug in commercial quantities in this country. It is still in the laboratory stage. If you will protect yourselves against the original infection, Homo Dementicus, and the secondary infection, Homo Do-Nothing-Cus, life in the long run will be much easier, immeasurably happier, and infinitely loftier. To Pharaoh afflicted with a tertiary infection of Homo Do-Nothing-Cus, and demanding an easier highway to the mastery of geometry than his subjects trod, Euclid bluntly said, "Your Majesty, there is no royal road to geometry." To you graduates who expect to go far in intellectual pursuits, I would like to say that the bug Homo Stilumcus will not help you in the least in the mental fields, because you cannot steal someone else's knowledge of or wisdom. Better accept that fact and make up your minds either to work, hard work, day and night, year in and year out, or to fail. God so created us that no man can by inheritance pass either his knowledge or his wisdom to his son. Every man gets these things for himself and for himself alone. This leads me to say that the only real use to us of an illustrious ancestry, a so-called first family setup, is to give us something to live up to. John, baptizing in the Jordan, cried out to the Pharisees and Sadducees who, boasting of their ancestry, came to his baptism, "O generation of vipers, think not to say within yourselves, 'We have Abraham to our father.' For I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. This did not leave much for the haughty children of Abraham to boast about. The rocks were as good as they. Teaching in the treasury of the temple in the last days of his mission, and speaking to the Jews who were again boasting that Abraham is our father, Jesus declared, if ye were Abraham's children, ye would do the works of Abraham. This tells our divinely declared obligation towards great ancestry. Do their works. Thank God for your noble parentage. And pray God you may not dishonor it. Do not disgrace yourselves by seeking to trade on it. Born of goodly parents, be ye goodly parents in turn to those who follow you. Near kin to this thought is another, voiced by God to Moses on the Mount. You know, some of our religious modernists deny that God can speak. I am blessed with a simple faith that necessity and occasion demanding God can and does speak to us. I'm not one of those who, professing an infinite, all-wise, all-powerful being, proceed then to hedge him about with the limitations conceived by human reason. Let's have a real God, with all the glory, power, and wisdom that God has revealed through his scriptures, or else let's cast him into the dung heap. Now God said to Moses on Sinai, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Jesus told the taunting, caviling scribes and Pharisees that this meant the child should care for the parent. And Paul instructed Timothy that children and nephews should requite their parents and declared, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. The great bard caught the vision when he had King Lear declare, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. You young folk, do not turn over to the public care. In public or private poorhouses, either the mother who gave you birth or the father who provided your sustenance. Lovingly care for your parents in need. Do not alibi your failures by pleading yourselves the victim of hard luck. Hard luck is usually just poor planning and non-action. Sometimes a chance set of circumstances may work ruin upon us, but not often. The Savior told the Syrophoenician woman seeking to have her daughter healed, it is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. She replied, truth, Lord. Yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table. As a humble and albeit very meager scientific crumb eater, I want to point a principle with some crumbs of science I was able to lick up from the floor when I was at college more than 50 years ago. Crumbs as I now remember them. As I remember, we were then taught that some molecules are very stable. Their component members are completely satisfied with their association together. They live in peace and comfort. They move among their like fellow molecules without either molesting or molestation. They are happy families. They make up the substance that give to the whole universe its stability and permanency. Then we're told that there were also unstable molecules. Their component members have a tendency to break away from one another when the first opportunity presents. They attack other molecules and seek to attach themselves thereto. Given their uncontrolled way, they would, so far as we crumb eaters are advised, break down and completely destroy the universe as we know it. We would pass away with the universe. I do not need to press my crumb eater science further. The family is a social molecule. Some family molecules are satisfied. They are the warp and the woof of the whole social structure, which is weak or strong, as they are few or many. And without them, our civilization will disappear. The constituent members of those family molecules live in peace and harmony. They leave their family, other family molecules, unmolested. They may be counted upon in times of stress and turmoil to stand for the welfare of all. They are they whom the Lord loves. There are dissatisfied family molecules. The members are bound loosely together. They tend to fly off on tangents. They attack other family molecules and seek to break them up. They may not be counted upon in times of stress. They have no regard for the confusion they may cause, nor the upsetting they may produce. Given their way, the family molecule would cease and society would become a chaos of brutes. Mother love, the holiest thing we mortals know, would be blotted out from the world. The sacred bond of father and son would be ground to dust. The grand design framed in the council of heaven would fail. God would be mocked. I need not belabor that matter further. You have my point. Now some brief words of general counsel. Do not whimper over your failures. The world is no use for a crybaby. Stand on your own feet. Do not lean on somebody else. They may get tired of holding you up and let you fall. If you cannot stand alone, you cannot get up alone. So you could be a long time down. Be cheerful. Remember, laugh and the world laughs with you. Weep and you weep alone. A word about work. In his lines of unequaled majesty and beauty, Milton has Adam say to Eve as he led her to the nuptial bower, God hath set labor and rest as day and night to man successive, and the timely dew of sleep, now falling with soft slumberous weight, inclines our eyelids. Other creatures all day long rove idle, unemployed, and less need rest. Man hath his daily work of body or mind appointed, which declares his dignity and the regard of heaven on all his ways, while other animals unactive range, and of their doings God takes no account. Work is the nearest substitute for genius, and genius without work is barren. If more people had to work for a living instead of talking for it, the world would be better off. Work for your living. The experience and habit may come in handy sometime. Beyond price are the worth and strength of men's trust in our integrity. Their idle praise lends us no help. A wise man learneth his own strength, but a fool thinketh he has no weakness. The censure of just men is our disgrace, but the jealous caviling of the unrighteous is our honor. The bigotry of unbelief is just as tyrannical as the bigotry of belief. Men are prone to condemn and deride in others the abilities and qualities of character they do not themselves possess. Do not declare as a vice in others a trait you claim as a virtue for you in yourselves. Dignity is often the cloak with which vanity enshrouds mediocrity. Neither a facile pen nor a glib tongue is a necessary counterpart of wisdom. It is greater, infinitely so, to lead men's minds than to conquer their bodies or control their wills. Modesty and virtue are now going at such a premium that many people are closing out all they have. The peace of an upright heart is more precious than place or power or riches. Out of the mists and shadows of history comes the certainty of revelation, the voice of God. Build around yourselves an impregnable fortress of righteousness, and then depart not from your citadel. For your social contacts, weep not too much over the parting guest, lest he remain on and so dull the edge of hospitality. Nor be too gay at his going, lest he mistake your feelings and believe he has overstayed his welcome. A few words in conclusion. You graduates, most of you are youngsters, however much you may at the moment feel otherwise, are in greatest number going out into the world with an immediate major business of mating in lawful wedlock, even as God ordained in the beginning when he commanded men to multiply and replenish the earth. Mating is essentially a matter of the heart. Sex should be held under control. Where it is master, disaster follows. Each of you should make himself and herself worthy of a meeting that shall last through the eternities. This demands the righteous life. Build, maintain, and preserve stable, satisfied, honorable family molecules. Guard against the species attacks and inroads of the members of the unstable, dissatisfied family molecules. The home where dwells the righteous family is as of heaven itself, the most of heaven we mortals are able to enjoy. So build, I beseech you. You men and women, all and each of you, remember always, chastity is more precious than life itself. It is the hallowing glory of true womanhood. It is the sanctifying grace of noble manhood. It is the mother of peace, contentment, and happiness here, and a fountain of never-ending joy in the eternities to come. It is commanded by God of maid and youth equally. It is the keystone of the righteous life. It is food for the soul. It pleases God, for he commanded it from the beginning. To Pilate questioning him in the judgment hall, after he had been accused by the Jews of perverting the people and being a traitor to Caesar, Jesus said, "To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." Pilate saith unto him, "What is truth?" Thus was thrust into the pagan world of thought a new concept, the Christ and spiritual truth. That concept has dominated Christian thought and life from that day until the present. It is the warp and woof of the spiritual lives of you here today. The truth which Christ proclaimed as he walked the earth and since leads us to immortality and eternal life, which God declared was both his work and his glory. That truth is open to and within the reach of all born of mortal mothers. It will bring all who learn it and live it to the goal God declared for men. History makes clear that in the very early days of the Christian era, this spiritual truth of the Christ began to be lost, and that the holy priesthood disappeared through which that truth was implemented. I bear my witness that the spiritual truth of which the Messiah spoke has been again revealed from heaven for the blessing of mankind, and that the holy priesthood which authorizes man to act as the agent of the Lord in his work has been again restored to the earth through the prophet Joseph Smith, who was ordained thereto under the hands of John the Baptist as to the Aaronic priesthood, and by Peter, James, and John as to the Melchizedek priesthood. I bear my testimony to the actuality of the first vision of the prophet Joseph, when the Father and the Son appeared to him for the opening of this, the last dispensation, the dispensation of the fullness of times. I add a testimony to the divine origin of the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price, as declared by Joseph Smith. I testify that they who live the teachings and keep the commandments of the restored gospel will be heirs to the celestial glory. I bear my testimony that God lives, the Father of us all, that the Christ is the Redeemer of the world, reclaiming us from the fall of Adam, that he is the Son of God, the only begotten of the Father, that he lived, worked, was crucified, died, and buried in the tomb, on the third day rising a resurrected being, that thereafter he ascended to heaven and again took his place on the right hand of the Father, that through his atonement all mankind may be saved. I urge with all the earnestness I possess that each of you live in obedience to gospel principles in order that you may inherit the celestial glory and go on progressing through the eternities until you shall become perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. This destiny was commanded by the Christ himself. I ask you to remember the gift which Jesus, soon to be crucified, promised in the Passover chamber to them who were his disciples, then and always. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. Graduates, may the blessings and peace of the Lord go with you. May he help you to appraise values, that you may not barter away precious things for things that are dross. May he help you always to live in accordance with his commandments, that you may be ushered finally into the celestial kingdom. I pray in the name of Jesus. Amen.